History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. We've learned that they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take the initiative to ask a few questions and take the time to patiently listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, it just so happens that we're educated, we're entertained, and really we are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The 99-year-old you're going to hear from today, Ralph Graham, lives in Waco, Texas. Just within the last year, he has published a book called 12 Minutes, The Untold Story of the Ghost Plane at the Battle of the Bulge. You're going to hear about why the book carries that title, but this interview was not recorded in the Lone Star State. In Atwater, California, rather, at Castle Air Museum, home to dozens of historic aircraft like the B-17 Flying Fortress, the kind of bomber Ralph flew 33 missions in during World War II. But Ralph Graham has a deeper connection to Castle Air Museum. His connection is to the mission that earned the museum's namesake, our nation's highest military honor. And to put that in perspective for us, we're going to hear first from the executive director of Castle Air Museum, Joe Pruzzo. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you can see this 99-year-old Army Air Corps veteran, Ralph Graham, hitting the opening tee shot for Castle Air Museum's annual golf tournament. Ralph and his family foursome fared very well in that tournament, but the history he represents tells a much bigger story. So let's allow Joe Pruzzo to shed some light on that before we hear from Mr. Graham.
Well, first off, it was a great honor and privilege to meet someone from the greatest generation that took part in the battle high above the skies of the Battle of the Bulge, certainly one of the most significant engagements of World War II. What's even more impressive is his connection to the museum's namesake, the former Air Force base's namesake, General Frederick Walker Castle, and knowing that he was in a formation of 2,000 B-17 Flying Fortresses that were being commanded by General Castle is really a significant, to us, a milestone. Talk about coming full circle. Many of your listeners may or may not know General Castle on that mission was flying a brand new airplane in the lead position. He had an engine failure. He had to drop to the back of the formation. And when he did that, he became an easy prey for Luftwaffe fighters. And he ultimately, rather than drop bombs over friendly troops, he and his pilot ultimately gave the supreme sacrifice and let the crew bail out before General Castle and his pilot could bail out. The airplane exploded. We actually have parts of that airplane here in our museum that we exhibit in the indoor exhibit, along with his memorabilia and uniform and Medal of Honor. Many people out there don't realize that these were, 18, 19, 20-year-old men and right out of high school. That's a pretty tough way to grow up.
No doubt. And, you know, with regard to General Castle, there are a lot of people that were stationed at Castle Air Force Base when it was an active base. There are a lot of people who have come through the museum who see that name, and they really may not know the history behind the name. How important is that to you in preserving this history, in moving the museum forward, to hang on to that history and to tell the story of General Castle and the others like him?
It's our mission and ultimately goal to teach and educate people coming through the museum on the importance of General Castle and his sacrifices and men like him and those who served under him and how important their position in history is in preserving the free will of our nation, our freedoms, and those of our allies. And I would say there were thousands of people that served at Merced Army Airfield when it was first here, and then it was changed to Castle Air Force Base, I believe, in late 1946 in honor of General Castle. There are many that flew those harrowing missions. And not only in the European theater, but in the Pacific theater and all over the world. We have to remember World War II was, you know, when we talk about wars today, okay, the war on terror in Afghanistan is pretty geographically isolated or a certain geographic area of the world, but World War II encompassed the whole globe. That in itself is when you put it into context, is mind-boggling. So the sacrifices made, yes. Unfortunately, these are the things that aren't taught in history classes in school today. So it's up to museums like Castle Air Museum to teach young people and the people coming through on their sacrifices and the importance of air power.
And so you got to see Ralph Graham's golf swing. He hit the first tee shot for your golf tournament, and he also had his book. You have any of those books left?
Yes. We have a couple. We're going to be reordering some. It's called 12 Minutes, and what that signifies is Ralph Graham's airplane was also a new airplane, but they had a mechanical failure. So they went and got a broken-in or war-weary B-17, and in order to transfer gear and equipment, it took 12 minutes. So they were 12 minutes late in catching up with the formation. So that 12 minutes was pretty critical in the scheme of things. They actually bombed with another squadron that they weren't attached to, but ordered by General Castle to join up with any squadron they could. You can get it on Amazon as well, but if you get a chance, get it and read it, because it's a very gripping story, and it's something, and when I first picked it up, I couldn't put it down. I wanted to read more. To have someone that, within memory, not in a history book, was there on that particular day in that mission, Christmas Eve 1944, I'm in awe at. You know, it's not, I didn't read about this. I actually talked to a living person who was there.
And I just bring up the book, wondering if people hear this program and want to get the book. Yeah, they can order it on Amazon. But if they come up to check out a few planes at or a few dozen planes at Castle Air Museum, they might find it in the gift shop too?
We're going to have to order more, so we will try and get some expeditiously, but it is a certain treat, and it's really, add it to your library, because it's a real great historical treasure written from a personal account.
And anything else about Ralph specifically that made an impression on you?
Oh, a lot of things. You know, God bless him, he was able to shoot a 7 under par. At 99 years old, he doesn't look a day over 80, Paul. I wonder what his secret is. You know, maybe it's that golf swing. I don't know, but his mental capacities, as sharp as a tack, just a wonderful, warm gentleman that so typified that generation, the greatest generation. And unfortunately, there aren't a lot of them around anymore to pass on those stories. And, you know, the lessons learned, the lessons of World War II and the lessons of any conflict should never be forgotten. Because if they are, some point when generations forget, we'll repeat them. And we shouldn't allow ourselves to do that.
Which is exactly why this program exists. And with that, let's welcome in 99-year-old Ralph Graham of Waco, Texas, originally from Athens, Texas. Where is that, Ralph, for those of us who don't know? And what do you remember about your childhood there?
Athens is about 75 miles southeast of Dallas. And what I remember more about my childhood was what we lived on a farm. My father raised cotton and corn and, you know, and everything you could think about. And he taught me how to plow. And I remember when I was 9 years old, and he finally turned it over to me with plow and by myself with a Georgia stock and one horse pulling it. And he let me plow out the meadows, you know, and all of that. And it went on from that until I grew up, and then I got to hating it.
It's exciting for a while. Right,
but we did a lot of work, and he was a wonderful farmer. He grew everything. He, you know, we'd have everything. During the Depression, we had everything he'd raised. We even had a peach orchard. And I remember during all those hard times that people would come there to get milk and peaches and potatoes and Irish potatoes and canned meat. What he just give it. We had so much of it, and he didn't want people to suffer, so he would just give it away.
Wow.
And that was our neighbors, you know, had nothing but a house to live in. It was pretty rough times, you know. And, of course, I remember starting to school, and I remember we had sometimes had to walk 2 miles or 3 to get to school. That was before we had buses, you know, to pick us up. That was as I grew up in the, you know, ready for high school, the 5, 6, 7 years. And finally, I went, I graduated as a ninth grader, you know, and they sent me on to high school. And we only had 3 grades then. It had 9th, 10th, and 11th. That was it. You didn't go to the 12th. I remember all that, and then all the associates, you know, and my classmates.
Do you remember as a boy having some ambition of, hey, when I grow up someday, this is what I'm going to do with my life?
Well, I knew I wanted to do something, but I didn't. You know, at that time, you didn't. You know, there wasn't much. There wasn't much future to look to because it was hard. It was bad, you know, during the Depression. But I did want to. I really wanted to be in the engineers. When we enlisted, they asked you what you wanted to do, and I told them, you know, I'd like to be in that part where we built bridges and things like that. And that's where they put me, and that's where I served for about 16 months, all my time there. From that, there was a bulletin that came out that if you'd like to try out as an aviation cadet, you can go down and take the test. And I did, and I barely passed. But anyway, a classmate and mine went down and we tried, and both of us did. And I went on through. I don't want to get into that too much if you don't think so about the training.
Whatever you think is relevant, but okay. I am interested on the timing. So when you went from the regular Army to the aviation program, was that before or after Pearl Harbor?
That was after. That's the reason they sent this bulletin out, because they needed air, you know, if it could pass.
Right. So tell me about, though, December 7th. Where were you, and how'd you find out what happened?
December 7th, I was, of course, still in the engineers, and we was walking down the street, been down to the recreation room, and we got back up to the door where you go in the barracks, and somebody hollered out, says, the Japanese had hit Pearl Harbor. Well, I didn't even know where Pearl Harbor was, you know. I hadn't been in the Army, you know, that long enough to know that. But anyway, that was my first time I knew that was in war.
And where was that? Where were you?
That was in San Antonio, the 2nd Infantry Division, and the 2nd Engineers was part of it. You know? Mm-hmm. But anyway, that's where I was. We came up from boot camp up to it.
And did you see things changing a lot after Pearl Harbor?
Oh, you bet. I think we're about 350,000 people in the services then, and we watched it grow and just tumble. It's just thousands after thousands that came in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the reason they wanted to pick out somebody that had, I did have a high school education, you know, had to do that to qualify to train. Well, anyway, I trained for, went through primary and then basic.
You're thinking you're going to be a pilot.
I learned to fly.
Mm-hmm.
But something happened. It really happened in primary. I felt something, you know, in doing aerobatics like spins and loops and all that, where the strain was on you. I felt pressure in my lower part of my body. Well, I made it all right in that plane, but when I went to basic, well, when we went from 165 horsepower to 450.
Was that from a Stearman to a BT-13 or something?
That's what it was, the old T vibrator, they called it.
So it's a big difference in power.
Oh, yeah, and that showed up bad. So I went to the doctor and told him I was having trouble. He said, well, the only thing he could do was re-operate. So I went back and I tried again, you know, to see if I could make it through. And I blacked out. And I went on back and told him, let's operate. I wanted to finish so bad. I said, go ahead and operate. And he did, but it didn't help. You can't fly a plane with that, you know. So I told him I didn't want to go on paperwork until that cured out. I wanted to go on. So they sent me on to radio school.
How disappointing was that for you at the time?
It was bad, because I wanted to be an officer, you know.
Yeah.
But that was all right. You know, I didn't want somebody to give me something. So I went on to radio school, finished that, and then the gunnery school, finished that, and they put a cruiser up. We went through, you know, the basic part of a team working together. Of course, from there in, it was up through the northern part. We flew over and carried a bomb bay full of GI mail. We left one night about sundown and got about halfway, and they turned us back on account of the weather closed in Iceland. So We came back and waited a few days longer, and it cleared up, and this time we made it. Bunch of kids.
I was going to say, was that a little nerve-wracking for you? You'd never been through anything like that before.
Flying across, you know, 1,500 miles of water. Well, the pilot did kind of, he became a little worried every once in a while. He said, call the navigator and say, how we doing? Well, we're on course. That's about all he knew. And I did. I called him once and told him the radio traffic was sounding louder, you know, and he said, that's some relief. And so, of course, we finally, navigator was right. We went right on money. That was really the last part of the war because we didn't go over till October of 1944. And all this stuff that I wrote about the book, that happened Christmas Eve of 1944. So, but we still training all times. Some of the crews have been there and did that. They kept us out, you know, and what we should have looked forward to, you know, prepared us for the mission, you know.
Were you a little anxious before your first mission?
You know, I wasn't. We went to Ham, Germany. That was the shortest mission over there, and I guess they did that on purpose. But, of course, we didn't have enough sense to be scared, you know. But we finally picked it up, you know, that it was dangerous.
Well, I'm always curious, too, because, you know, you've been looking at it in hindsight for most of your life now.
Right.
But before that, I mean, even before you're going overseas, some guys have told me, you know, I was invincible. Nothing was ever going to happen. Other guys have said, hey, I knew it could be me at any moment. Did it weigh on you at all, the possibility that you could be killed over there?
Well, sure, everybody has fright. But one of the things that helped us most was those 16 months that I spent in the regular Army.
Mm-hmm.
When we were trained, like they made men out of boys, so to speak, you know. We'd go on marches and march all night long and then rest, and several times the rain would be pouring down. And we'd lay down on the ground, and the rain wouldn't even bother us. We'd sleep 30, 40 minutes, and up going again, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And things like that. And then went to Louisiana for maneuvers, and it's the same old story. You lay there in a pup tent, and then it rained that night, and you'd have water marks on your legs. But, you know, things like that toughens you up, and you learn to give and take, you know, and say, well, this is going to happen. Yeah, but do this. So It really did help, because I could tell some of the younger people that didn't do that went directly into the Air Force.
So it sounds like you're saying that time in the Army helped you understand that you could handle and endure more than you maybe thought.
You're still frightened, scared, of course, especially on different situations. But overall, it really helped. It sure did.
And I guess another, you know, thought that comes to mind, if you hadn't volunteered for aviation cadet training, you might have been one of those guys on the ground at the Battle of the Bulge.
Incidentally, they were. The second engineers was one that the Germans was running over. The fog was so heavy, even they didn't know what they were hitting.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the guys said that we lost some of the people that I soldiered with. The tanks would run over them. Because, like I say, the Germans couldn't. It was a mess, you know. The book will tell about that, but that's actually what it was.
So you don't have to speculate or wonder. You know where your unit was and what happened to them.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come with 99-year-old Ralph Graham of Waco, Texas, including details from that Christmas Eve mission in 1944. While those beleaguered troops on the ground in the Battle of the Bulge finally had air support, there were airmen who gave their lives for our country that day, including General Frederick Castle. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos and a short video with today's guest, Ralph Graham, as well as a link to his book, 12 Minutes. And Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you're a business owner, I've got a phone number you really ought to take down, 800-989-1139. And when I say business owner, I mean businesses of all shapes and sizes, from the multinational chain to the hot dog stand on the corner, or my personal preference, the taco truck. 800-989-1139. Because you can have the greatest product or service in the world, the best business plan, the most capable workforce, and still not maximize your potential if you don't have a reliable, efficient, and versatile plan for processing payments. 800-989-1139. That's the number for my friends at Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in the country. Why is Provident growing so fast? Because they're committed to helping your business grow. 800-989-1139. That nonprofit you love that relies on donations? Provident can even connect you to a special software platform to streamline and stimulate giving. If you are ready to grow, give it a go. Go Provident today at providentpayments.com or call that number, 800-989-1139.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation today with 99-year-old Ralph Graham of Waco, Texas, author of the book 12 Minutes, The Untold Story of the Ghost Plane at the Battle of the Bulge. Ralph spent nearly a year and a half in an Army engineer outfit before volunteering for aviation cadet training. His hopes of becoming a pilot were derailed by a painful physical issue in his lower body. And his aerial exploits would come as a radio operator on B-17s with the 836th Squadron, part of the 487th Bomb Group, flying out of England.
What were some of the hazards that you had to face, that mission after mission you started to get more familiar with?
Well, after the invasion, and we took France, you know, they moved the Air Force aviation and fighters over so they could follow us all the way around, all the way through the mission.
So you could have fighter escort and not
right.
be naked.
Yeah. And at that time, there had been enough. Now, remember, this way up in 44, we had just about knocked out every oil target that they had. But they was having to ration gasoline, and that's the reason we wasn't bothered too much with fighter. It was the flak that hurt us worse. And some of the targets was more heavily protected than some. Some of them have as high as 800 guns around it.
And if you flew 33 missions, I have to imagine that you encountered a fair amount of flak.
Oh, we did. Yes, we did.
What was that like for you? Can you help us, take us into that,
well,
that B-17, let us feel what
right.
it felt like?
Well, the worst part really was on what we call the initial point. That's where the bomb bays come open, the doors come open, and we're going to turn it over to the bombardier. And he had to guide that plane exactly on course. We couldn't dodge nothing. When it was about 18 or 20 minutes, you just took whatever came. And that's the part that we couldn't dodge nothing until the bombs went out. And then we could go whichever we wish. I say flak, heavy flak here. We'd go to the right or left or up. But that was the worst part. The last 6 or 8 months was the flak.
And can you give us an example of how close it came to you?
Yes, it came awful close. The redder it was when it burst, if you saw red, you know it was right at you. But we got used to that, and we'd look and see if it was all black, and you were kind of out of the way. But once it starts showing up red, you could hear a little bit of stuff hitting the base of the plane or the body of the plane. And you always felt, well, maybe if it just hit my shoe heel, it'll help. You know, it's that kind of a thing. You're just so tense. But, you know, and then, of course, you're sitting there praying. Yeah, and you didn't have really time to do anything. It was awful quiet. Someone asked us if there was any people who didn't believe in God up there. I said, no, not on my plane.
Well, that's always, you know, every member of a bomber crew I've talked to, that's one thing that's always struck me is their perspective on those moments when you know you're flying through a field of flak and there's nothing you can do about it. Sounds pretty helpless.
It is helpless.
So that was your strategy, was sit there and pray?
Absolutely. You had a prayer on your tongue because you didn't know what. I've seen them hit. A plane one leading us once. What happened? I'll tell this little story, and then we'll go back. We went to Berlin, and it was late in the game, and we bombed a target. There wasn't any flak there. They'd moved all those flak guns to the eastern front and used them as artillery pieces. But on the way back, we dropped down to get off of oxygen, down to 10,000 feet. Well, our lead plane got hit. It blew the nose off. All I could see was just they took it and then just broke it off, even with the back was a pilot area. There wasn't no way that the pilot or the co-pilot or the engineer could live. And I saw two bodies out of that short time that I had to see it. They was in a spread formation like this. One of them was. You know, he didn't have time to even do anything except probably blew his hands up. In fact, we tried to. And my pilot had to take over and lead, and that I never could see us. It peeled off about like that, you know, and I watched it as long as I could, but I never seen it shoot. So we just assumed, you know, that was complete loss. But at 10,000 feet, they didn't have much time, if they could have.
Yeah.
We didn't know that it didn't, but we just assumed that it didn't.
That's got to be hard to watch.
Yeah, it was. It sure was. And then there we was at 10,000 feet, couldn't do nothing but maybe dodge one if we had to. Didn't last long. What they did, they put these AK-AK guns on a barge, and it was on the river. And they didn't do nothing coming in. They just set the trap for us. They knew what we'd do, drop down. If we didn't see anything, quick as you could, get off oxygen, you know. Boy, they didn't. We had several of them that hit, but the only thing they hit was pieces that come off of that plane, the nose was knocked off. They didn't get any AK-AK on it. But it was a bunch out of it, and you're not that kind of fright, but you're tore up, you know. Till you get home, get you a drink, a couple of drinks. They always interviewed, you know, and they'd give you a drink, a little bourbon, whatever you wanted.
Uh-huh.
So you could talk. They wanted to know what happened and when and how much damage you did and all that stuff. Really, what they did, they prepared for the next mission on the information they gathered out of us.
Right.
Interview.
Maybe I should have you explain for folks who wouldn't know, your job as a radio operator on that B-17, from takeoff to landing, what are some of the things that you're responsible for?
Okay, first of all, at that time we had shooting flak stuff to avoid flak.
Throwing some chaff out or something?
Chaff, that's what I had to throw it all out.
Uh-huh.
But my other jobs was to, if the pilot was uncertain about his direction and he had lost his radio compass, he had asked me to get a QDM or the direction for him to follow. And I'd do that. They'd call it all and tip it in. They'd send it right back, you know. That, and I'd get weather reports, and I'd get send in the bombing results as much as I could, get as much as I could get out of the bombardier.
Mm-hmm.
He was the one that was reporting it. And help the other guys if I could. I didn't have a gun until this bull started, you know, and they pulled one of the gunners off, and I had to take his place.
Well, and that's what your book revolves around, the Battle of the Bulge. And I've heard, you know, from so many guys over the years that were on the ground there freezing their tails off, hoping that the skies would clear so you guys could fly and help them.
Absolutely.
What was it like for you guys waiting for an opportunity to actually fly?
8 days we sat there. The fog was so thick that you couldn't drive a truck across without some help, flashlights. All we could do is listen. And the report was bad every day, you know, because the Germans, I don't want to get too far in that book because I explained that. The Germans had recognized that it was going to have that fog. We didn't know anything about it, but a young German scientist had discovered a weather condition out over the North Sea that indicated that that was going to happen. So the German command just took advantage of it and prepared everything, tanks and everything. So when the fog came in that night, they took off and they pushed us back, and nobody realized how close they drive, like driving us into the sea. That British general, he was on, it's Christmas time. He'd already gone home for Christmas. They had to get him back. And, of course, there were three armies there that was pushing back. And if they'd pushed us back, they would have delayed us. They might not have lost the war, but they would have delayed us a long, long time.
And how much were you guys aware of, you know, in your bomb group as you're waiting for the opportunity to fly? Did you know what was happening at bulge and how dire
absolutely.
This knee was?
Yeah, and we were sitting there helpless. Mm-hmm. We got to report every hour, all the time during the day, where they were and what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
If they're making a stand or if they're still giving up, still retreating. Then that morning the fog lifted just as fast as it came, you know. You could look up and boy, and the stars were shining like diamonds, you know.
This is Christmas Eve, 1944?
That was right.
Was that unexpected when it cleared that way?
We didn't know. It just cleared up just like it came, you know.
Uh-huh.
We didn't know that it was going to clear up.
Yeah.
We were sitting there waiting and waiting, and about midnight it did. And you could hear all kind of noises, telephones ringing and communications chattering, you know, and it's getting ready. Everybody's for maximum effort, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we knew we might as well get up and get our clothes on.
Here we go.
That's the way it happened. They briefed us on what was happening, where we was going to go. And then from then on, my book takes over. But it didn't last too long. We pulled out on the runway to check, make our final check, and found our problem. And then we had about 12 minutes to go back and get another one. And then from then on, it was a mystery.
So you're hitting it. One of the reasons the book is called 12 Minutes. So, and I've heard a lot of these stories over the years of, you know, if it didn't happen just like this, all these other things might have happened. So just so everyone understands and wants to buy the book and read a little more about it, you guys are on the runway. You're getting ready to take off. You're going to go support the troops at the Battle of the Bulge. And there's something wrong with the plane?
That's right. We had to go and pick up another plane that they always have sitting there loaded, ready to go in case somebody has that problem.
Had you guys ever dealt with that before?
No, it's the first time. I don't know. I guess first time our squadron ever done it.
So was that a little unsettling?
It really was. We didn't know what was happening because there was a new plane. The women had just flew it in from the States, hitting several others. We didn't understand. We didn't know what was I didn't know what was going on anyway. But later he told me what it was.
What was it?
You know, your alternator on a car, if it goes out, you don't have any power.
Right.
When you're sitting on the ground, you're on batteries. But once you're ready to take off, the batteries, you can't go with you. You're depending on electrical current.
Right.
And we checked them, and it always going to fall a little bit, you know. But this one went plumb pegged down. That means you may not even get off the runway, depending on how much, what it was putting out.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't take any kind of a chance.
So you guys have to go back, and everybody gets off this B-17, you transfer onto another one.
Right, and it took about 12 minutes.
Uh-huh. How big a difference did that 12 minutes make?
Well, it made a lot. We started, I thought we ought to abort, because you could take a pencil and a tablet and figure out yourself in small and just arithmetic that there wasn't no way we could catch them before they get to the target.
Because you've got a whole group of B-17s.
They're 40 miles ahead, and we'd had to make up that time, and we came 225 miles as fast as you can go with the load. If we had to increase that enough to get there, we wouldn't have made it anyway.
So you're not going to catch up and become part of the formation.
That's
just
right.
Not going to happen.
So we flew on. No, I didn't know what we were going to do. And we got a call from him.
From General Castle?
General Castle said, we're under attack. Well, the pilot said, well, now what we should do? He said, just join another crew. Well, it wasn't long after that till he was shot down. Tried to contact him, but he was done gone.
So if you had been with the original group of planes, you would have been part of that fighter attack as well.
That's right. And I'll tell you, as we go along, we went ahead and finally made it. It was pretty tough even to join another group because they don't like to see a single plane come up to join without reporting why you're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Germans did take one of them old planes that crashed and pick it up, and they'd come back and fly it and get into contrails and cause a lot of problems, you know.
Sure.
So we joined them, and it was, wanted to know what our armor was. We told him we was carrying 2 500-pounders. He said, that's what we need. We're going to knock a bridge out over a certain river. We didn't know what river it was because we wasn't briefed for that mission, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what we did. We knocked it out and came back and finally went home. And when we got home, we found out what had happened, that they had said they'd knocked down 9 planes. Well, said 4 of them that was knocked down by the German fighters, and the rest of them had force landed or built out there at Liege. It was a little town outside of Brussels. And we found out that they had made that mistake. They thought we was down because of our squadron commander, who didn't fly that day, looked at us and says, I'm looking at a ghost. Says, y'all was reported dead, down, or missing. Nobody knew whether it was which one it was. And as far as I was concerned, I tried to figure out why he didn't report it.
He didn't report
us as missing,
mm-hmm.
But he didn't report it that there was SD-8 planes because we was in the 9th.
You would have been the 9th plane, but instead there were only 8.
That's right, there's only eight, because we was, they thought there's right, and they were, because there was only four reported back.
Mm-hmm.
But if you take four and you add us, and that's five, and you subtract that from 13, you get eight. See? That's one of the reasons I wrote the book, and nobody ever knew the difference. They even made a report article on that mission, and they still reported nine planes missing. And then I got a little piece of that letter in my book. You can magnify it and see whether they still said nine planes missing.
And that was the official Army Air Corps report of the mission?
That's right. It was such a mixed up thing, you know. In addition to that, we had 50 airplanes that came in and landed on our. And there we were. Christmas was the eve, Christmas Day was next day, and they was boiling turkey and everything, getting ready. But the confusion just wiped out any reason for any of them to ever doubt, other than that fact that he told us.
So let me understand. So you guys go ahead, you join another group. You're not with your squadron. You're flying with another group. You drop your 500-pound bombs on the target, and then you're flying back to your base. But when your pilot brings the plane down and you land, you get off, you guys see the squadron commander?
Yeah, that's right. He walked into the headquarters.
Uh-huh.
Our pilot did.
When your pilot walks in.
He looked at, and they were really good friends. He said, man, I'm looking at a ghost.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were already reported, as quick as it happened, that the one that took over reported the one that wasn't there. They knew who was flying, and they knew the one that joined them was four planes. That's how come them to sank. Well, there's nine plane missing. They didn't know. Say nobody had any idea that we wasn't in the group. Avon Castle didn't know until he called us and called everybody and said, we're under attack. And we was listening, and we called him back. And he said, just go on around. We told him he was 40 miles away. Just go ahead and join another group.
It's break time again, but there's much more to come with 99-year-old Ralph Graham, including what compelled him to write the book, 12 Minutes. Again, I have that linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. You're also going to be able to pick it up in the gift shop at Castle Air Museum in Atwater, California, where this interview was recorded. And Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328. When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 99-year-old Ralph Graham. He was the guest of honor this year at the annual golf tournament supporting Castle Air Museum in Central California. And more than 76 years ago now, he was on the same bombing mission that would prove to be the final mission for that museum's heroic namesake, General Frederick Castle. If you ever have the chance to visit the Air Force Memorial in our nation's capital, you will find Castle's name inscribed on a black granite wall there with other Air Force recipients of the Medal of Honor. Ralph Graham is one of the only remaining veterans who was in the air as part of Castle's final mission on December 24th, 1944.
So, you've had a lot of time to think about this.
Absolutely.
I imagine you may have some different emotions for different aspects of it. What are some of the things you think about when you consider that twist of fate or the uniqueness of the difference that 12 minutes made in your life and others?
I wrote it down. It's in there. And I said this, the Germans had 8 days that they didn't fly. We had 8 days we didn't fly. You had any time to make proposals on what to do. The Germans prepared too, but when it came to be, the Germans was prepared. We wasn't, because who's going to send out the whole 8th Air Force being led by a squadron that didn't have one escort plane? Mm-hmm. But yet there was thousands of them in the area. But we didn't have one. Now, the tale was they were supposed to join us at a certain point, but the fog had not lifted in that particular area, and they couldn't get off the ground. We should have had escort from time to wheels up on takeoff,
mm-hmm.
because we were leading the whole 8th Air Force in. Castle was.
How much did you know about him at the time?
I didn't even know him. See, he came down from Wing headquarters to fly that one mission. We didn't know who was Wing, you know how many planes that is, or how many, that's three groups.
Right.
And three groups, you're talking about, we had 39 planes. Multiply that from three, that's over 100. And he was in charge of that. But he came down to fly that one mission, leading everybody in.
And he didn't have to.
No. He was a brigadier general.
Right.
He just made general.
What does that say about him, that he wanted to be there leading that mission, even though he'd already flown all those missions and accomplished so much and didn't need to be out there doing what he did?
Well, they said that he had flown more bad missions than anybody. I said, well, you know, time will get you. But when he went down, he was very calm about what was happening. And then, of course, next thing we knew, they were bailing out.
And you were hearing this on the radio?
No, that's what people told us, you know, that was in the mission. In fact, one of them I met later on at San Antonio when we had a reunion was a waste gunner, I think, and he said he was one of the that bailed out. But they said he couldn't have never got out because both feet was on fire.
Mm.
But even with that, he got it. He wanted to guide that plane away from anything on the ground because we was over friendly territory, you know. He wanted to guide it into an open field. That's what he had told the co-pilot. He says, y'all go, I can't get out. He says, I'll take it in. That's what makes you want to keep this thing going.
That's why you're here.
Mm-hmm. That's the reason why we're here today.
So what do you think about when you see his name out there?
Well, that's where heroes were born. I mean, you think about it, the first thing you think about then is, I don't know how many we got, but there's a man that knew he was going to die. And he did what he did for a purpose. He knew he couldn't make it because he couldn't even walk to the bailout. So it makes you wonder. Even though I didn't know him, I had never known him, I didn't know who that Castle was. Well, I learned to respect him, being a part of our efforts.
Well, and for you. Okay, so General Castle was a hero. He knew that he was giving his life for our country. And
I knew that. Mm-hmm.
What would have happened to you if that first plane you guys tried to take off in would have been okay, and you would have been in the formation? What do you really think?
I suppose that I would be like all the rest, that you would do the best thing that you could do. Now, we did have one. I'll tell you about this.
All right.
and we don't know who he, what he, what position he was, but he had a breakdown. They couldn't treat him over there. They needed to send him home. Well, they found out that they had a plane leaving in North, in the RCAF, the Royal Canadian Air Force, and they had a plane leaving the next day. So we made it back, and they picked Crockett to fly him up there. Well, it takes crew, skeleton crew, to carry one of those things up. So it took a navigator, me, engineer, and the pilot. There's four of them. And we carried him up. And I remember stepping back in the waist to speak to him. But he was so heavily sedated that you couldn't talk. And he had civilian clothes on, so we don't know what he was. But we kind of figured that it could have been a co-pilot because he's the only crew member that had nothing to do under attack. Pilot had to fly. All the other positions had a gun. So it made it sensible to think that it might have been. We don't know for sure, never did, but we think it might have been a co-pilot.
What was the hardest thing for you to deal with?
Oh, I tell you what, we had such a great crew. We thought of a mission as a crew, you know, as a crew. But there were times when you could see things were happening to your crew, you know, they were what they call flat happy. That's when a guy starts laughing at things that's not funny. And you kind of try to figure out what can I say to him, you know, what can I do for him. And the best thing to do is just try to get back on something funny and forget about it. You know, we don't have to fly no more for a while. Let's do something.
What do you think enabled you to keep your wits about you?
Well, like I say, I had about 2 years more than the rest of the crew had. And I've been beat up a little bit, you know. That doesn't mean that you're eliminated from all of that, but it did help, and I had a lot of faith in the pilot. Boy, he was a dandy.
Crockett?
Crockett. Mm-hmm. He knew, like when we was coming over, when he got word, it was word because of the crew, you know, the responsibility that he bore. It was sort of stay with the crew attitude, you know, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're committed. But I spoke a little bit about that at the end of the book when we finished. So I think that's the reason why. You don't know how many people have called me. One guy sent me $100. Other people sending stuff in to me and stacked that high.
Because they read the book and
because
it touched them?
Because they read the book.
Why did you want to write the book?
Well, everybody on that crew wanted what had happened corrected, you know.
That you guys weren't shot down, you really made it back?
We every one of us. We didn't get a scratch.
So you wanted to set that record straight?
Absolutely. I wanted the record straight. And they did, too, because they was saying we got knocked down, and that's not right. And they just wanted the record straight. Every time we'd have a reunion, somebody would say, well, who's going to talk about it? And finally, when they were all gone, the last crew member died in 13.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, man, I got to do something.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to write it. And I did. I wrote it, and then I'd write it over. And then my buddies would help me, and they'd do the typing. And I didn't even type. I just writing out in pencil, you know.
Mm.
And it took about a year finally to get it to where I sent it in and asked them if they wanted to print it. And they called me back about 3 days later and said, yeah, absolutely.
What do you hope people get out of the book?
What those people have seen about how everything went, how we all reacted. It analyzes a mission, really, and how what can happen in case something happened to us like did us.
What was that Christmas like, the day after that mission?
Well, that's in the book, too. We knew we went in. The crew had just came in. They was in the same Quonset hut with us. In fact, the night before, we played pinochle and became acquainted with them pretty good. Well, we come in that night. Of course, they wasn't there. And it's our job to pick everything up that's their personal stuff and mail it home. But it was so quick, we didn't know whether they might have bailed out. We didn't want to start doing anything until we found out what happened to them. But it was a pretty dark day. We was going to have a Christmas party. And, of course, we had all the stuff laying on the cot. And instead of having a party, we just took all that stuff that a kid would like and carried it down to the orphan's home and gave it to them and come back and got ready for another mission the next morning because we had to keep doing something. You know, you can't sit there and fret, you know. As bad as it was, you still got to look ahead. After all this stuff that I wrote, it didn't get to it. But when them people saw that there was 9 planes that shot down out of a squadron, the head people up there losses. I mean, there were some necks took place, head, neck, and the bottom. There was a different command on every part of that thing.
Because that wasn't supposed to happen anymore. That happened a lot earlier in the war, but yeah, that wasn't supposed to happen anymore at this point.
That's right.
So because
the mistake, you know, was made on account of that fog.
The escort's not
but
been able to fly.
They should have prepared for it. I mean, you know, you went into the unknown when you started up again.
Mm-hmm.
And they should have been prepared. Nothing else, just had escort bars from takeoff, really.
Right.
Because he's going into the dark. I mean, as far as what's going to happen is concerned.
Yeah.
And we were, it was such a mess that these people on the ground were just absolutely torn all to pieces. And they seen that daylight come, and we started over. It really made you feel like, well, we were doing something. But even though they knocked down the 8 planes, we got 13 of theirs and 2 damaged and another probable. And I put all that in the book, too. If we'd had an escort, we never would have lost the plane, I'll tell you right through. Because we'd been sitting there at 14,000 feet waiting till they come up. We wouldn't never let them. They'd been underneath the bottom. They'd cut. They would never got up.
Have you had the occasion over the years to meet some of those guys who survived on the ground? Have you ever talked to them to find out how much they appreciated what you did?
The very first people, the people that I served with when I first went in, the engineers, I met some of them when I was discharged. And this one is telling me about the people that got run over by the tanks.
Right.
That's how come he didn't know it.
Mm-hmm.
They told us what was happening.
I don't want to leave anything out that's important to you. I am curious, when you came home from the war, what was different about you compared to the guy who went overseas?
That's in the book, too. I said, you know, I spent from childhood, in 18 year old, until I was 23. So I didn't know anything about a job or how to get one, and lost the first 3 rungs on the ladder that we're supposed to climb to reach the greats of American, you know. But I wanted people just to understand that, to kind of help me get going, my feet on the ground again. And they, of course, they did as best they could. But everything worked out fine. They really did. I had a great family.
Yeah, how many kids and grandkids and great-grandkids do you have?
Oh, my gosh. They're in the book.
You can read the whole list, huh?
There's a picture in the book of my, of all my relatives. 60 or 70. I couldn't tell you the number.
Well, I ask because it's a lot of people who might not be here if you hadn't taken off 12 minutes late.
That's exactly right. I told them that I'd been to a reunion, and I seen kids playing. I seen some fishing, some playing baseball, and I don't know how many, but I wondered what it would have looked like if it hadn't been for that 12 minutes. If it hadn't been for that, I might not have, that might have been blank, you know.
Well, if there's anything else you want to include, feel free. I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us this story.
I hope that you edit out maybe a little of this stuff.
Don't worry about that. I do have a couple more questions. One, at 99 years old, what would you say you're most thankful for?
Well, it really started way back 55 years ago. When I came out of the Army, like I say, I was lost. And like everybody else, I went with the gang. And I got on alcohol. And it got so bad that I had to do something. So one day, I was thinking, I'm not going to make it without help. But I got 4 kids, and I want to see that they get grown and married. And I just asked God to give me 20 years to do that in. Well, he's given me 60. So, you know, if you look at it in a broader picture than that, I don't have to say a thing. That was it.
And it doesn't sound like he's done with you yet.
I don't think he is. To live that long, I don't even have a doctor.
Is there anything that you haven't done in your 99 years that you're still looking forward to?
Just keep on keeping on. That's all. I've tried to help people if I can. That's what I want to do, help as many people as I can. And let them see what can happen when you got faith. And you try to live it, you know, if you just ask for strength to do it, you can do it.
Last thing, this Castle Air Museum, what does it mean to you, and why do you think it matters?
Oh, man, I owed something to him. Everybody does that was on that flight that lived.
And Ralph Graham is one of the last ones left to tell that story, a story captured in his book, 12 Minutes, The Untold Story of the Ghost Plane at the Battle of the Bulge. You heard a lot of that story today, but there's even more in the book. I have the link online for you at hometownheroesradio.com. And you heard Joe Pruzzo say they're hoping to keep it in stock at the gift shop at Castle Air Museum in Atwater, California, still bearing the name of a hero who was awarded the Medal of Honor for his supreme sacrifice on Christmas Eve, 1944. That's all the time we have on Hometown Heroes today. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.